Our first case this morning is Hollenbach versus Hollenbach. As you can see, Justice Pickering is present, and she is participating by way of video in Las Vegas from the Regional Justice Center.
Good morning, everyone. Is this system working adequately?
Yes. Can you hear us okay, Chris?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Justice Pickering. Mr. Grayson, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Okay.
My name is Robert Grayson. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case. This case, as the court is aware, involves a pension division in a divorce case. The pension involved clearly under Nevada law is community property. While the parties were separated for many years, they were not divorced while this pension was being accrued, and therefore the only issue before the court is whether under NRS 125.150 paragraph 1 the trial court could make an unequal disposition of the community property if it found a compelling reason to do so and set forth the reasons for making the unequal distribution in writing. I would direct the court to the transcript of the trial, page 10, lines 3 through 8, where the court says, and I quote, "It seems to me that even though the parties were married for the last, well, during the entire time the pension was accrued, that because Mrs. Hollenbach had left before any of that money was contributed to the pension, she's not entitled as a matter of community property. Even though they were legally married, there was not a community. So I'm not going to divide that for community property." Subsequently, in the written plea of divorce, the court simply said that the Carpenters Southwest pension plan benefits, while earned during the marriage, was earned after the party separated, and it's fair that they be set aside to the plaintiff. I submit that pursuant to NRS 125.150, that the court has not made any finding of any compelling reasons why the pension should not be divided, and in fact quoted, contrary to Nevada law, that he finds as a matter of community property they were not divisible. I submit on that basis alone, this court must reverse the finding of the district court. Should the court proceed further and try to determine whether or not, under these circumstances, there was some compelling reason, even though not stated by the court, I submit that that would be an inadvisable track for this court to take. For that, for a number of reasons. Number one.
Before you move, excuse me, I'm sorry with the video, it's awkward. But before you move on to that, Mr. Hollenbach was not represented at the time the final decree was entered, is that correct?
That is correct.
And is it correct that you prepared the written findings and decree that the judge signed?
I did, according to the instructions of the judge.
Okay, thank you.
If the court would make a finding, if this court would make a finding that there was some compelling reason to deviate from the equal division, I submit that it's a dangerous path for this court to take.
Counsel, are you suggesting then that the unusual circumstances here, although not stated by the judge as a compelling reason, the unusual circumstances that these parties never lived together during the time that the pension was being earned is not adequate to meet that criteria?
Exactly, I do, Your Honor, under the line of cases under Lofgren and Futterman. This court has only recognized financial misconduct as a reason for deviation from the equal distribution. The court, if it goes beyond that, setting forth a new path for the trial courts to follow in divorce cases. I submit that if the court is free to determine other factors, then the issue of division of or equal division of community property becomes an issue in every case hereafter. We have guidelines now. We say it's going to be equal. We say there must be compelling reasons. This court has said the compelling reasons are financial misconduct. If we go beyond that, unless things are very, very clear, we just create continued litigation in divorce courts. The Forrest versus Forrest case, which says property rights during marriage do not terminate upon separation. That case also said that pension benefits accrue through the time of the divorce.
In a circumstance like this, though, it's odd to me. The parties for a significant amount of time acted as if they were separated. It was a de facto separation, just without the legal end to it. They operated under the assumption they were fully separated, and they both were fully aware of the facts and circumstances during the separation. Is that fair?
I don't think it's unfair. I have had experience with cases. Here's an example. Another couple. They separate. They own a house together. The wife needs a place to live. She can make the payment on the house. They decide that, well, the only thing we have to divide is the house. You go ahead, live there, make the payment. When you die, it'll be mine, or we'll divide it up equally later. They don't do anything. They don't have any written agreements. They don't get a divorce. 10 years later, she has the house paid off. She meets a new boyfriend. She wants a divorce, and now she's saying, because I paid this house off over the last 10 years, I need an unequal division of the property. Cases like that can come up where if this court says, because the parties didn't do anything, because property accrued during the separation, that there can be an unequal division, we can have unfair results just from that finding.
How about the fact that the judge actually used words that I found interesting in that he said there was no community?
I think that was absolutely contrary to Nevada law. I think that was an abuse of discretion. I think that if the judge found a compelling reason, he could have made specific findings that would consider the fact that the parties had minor children, that the husband was significantly in arrears of child support, that there could have been other reasons for not getting a divorce. He just simply said there was not a community, and that's not Nevada law.
May I return to your hypothetical for a moment?
Yes.
On the house that after the people separate, the one lives in it and makes payments. In this situation, and what struck me as out of the norm, I take your point that it's a slippery slope, but here my understanding is he had a pension that he contributed to or was earning during their cohabitation, and that the pension, and that was entirely awarded to the wife, that the pension that is in contention, he didn't get that job or start earning those benefits until after these people were completely separated, and they never cohabited during the time he was working for the employer whose employment generated this pension. Is that correct?
Yes, with the following qualifications. Mr. Hollenbach was a carpenter. He was a carpenter under a different plan, the New York plan. He contributed to that. That was during the marriage. He continued to be a carpenter. He continued to be a union member, but when he moved to Las Vegas, he became part of a different plan. The amount of money that was available under the plan, the original plan, was just a few hundred dollars, not even an amount that justified the expense of doing a quadro. The parties continued to have a relationship through their children over the years. Mr. Hollenbeck went to work. He used the money on occasion to pay his child support and didn't pay his child support on many occasions, but the pension was accrued, yes, after he moved to Las Vegas, but still continuing as a carpenter.
So that was his trade during the marriage, is your point?
Yes.
Thank you.
If the court finds that an unequal distribution is available, the court can find that, well, this was just such a long time that it should be available. But then we are left with the question, what is a long time? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 5 years? When we litigate cases in the future and we look and it, if the court said in Hollenbeck that the majority of the pension was earned after the party separated, then we have lots of other questions to address as to time. We also have a situation where had the pension been earned entirely, had the pension been earned partially during the cohabitation and partially after separation, then how do we attribute the division of the pension? Other states have addressed this. Idaho says, yes, we have compelling circumstances, but then they codify the compelling circumstances so that courts and litigants have knowledge of what the law is and what we can expect. California has gone even further. California provides that the economic community ends when there's a permanent physical separation. If this court is going to address case by case what are compelling circumstances when the parties have been separated for a period of time, I submit that you are legislating, that this is a proper issue for the legislature to address. We have an unusual situation in this case, or in this state, where the legislature has provided for specific treatment of PERS contributions. They say, and it's very clear, that the community is up until the date of the signing of a divorce decree. If this court says, well, that's not the case in pensions that are not PERS pensions, then maybe we have an equal protection problem with NRS 125.155. I submit to the court that this case, by the award of the pension to Mr. Hollenbeck, contravenes the existing law of the state, and to hold otherwise just opens the subject to continued litigation. I think it's a case for the legislature to address. I think this court should follow the law as it is, saying there is equal division except when there's been financial misconduct, and even though the parties were separated, that the pension should be divided equally and the case be reversed for that finding. Thank you.
And you'd like to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Rusby, and I represent the respondent, Joseph Hollenbeck. In this case, Your Honor, the district court acted squarely within its discretion when it decided to divide Joseph's pension unequally. Nevada law provides the district courts with wide discretion in considering circumstances which, if that may weigh on whether an unequal division is the most just result in that particular case. That is exactly what the district court did in this case. The court rightly perceived the issue as one of judicial discretion. It acted within the outer bounds of such discretion and consistently with the applicable legal standards. And the court reached its decision by a product of reason and after a careful consideration of the evidence. The appellant's counsel has addressed that this would be a proper issue for the legislature to address. Well, it did address this issue when it amended NRS 125-150, and it specifically gave the court wide discretion to consider many different things, not just marital misconduct. There is no limitation in the statute or in the other cases dealing with marital misconduct where it limits compelling circumstances to only those instances. Other courts such as Idaho, who also applies the same type of division procedure, equal, but if there are compelling circumstances, it can be an unequal division. Those courts have not limited it to just one discrete set of facts. They have found that the court's free to consider any compelling circumstance. And I'd like to address the example raised by the appellant of the house example. The difference in that case is that the house was earned while they were still together. It was acquired, they lived in it. The difference here is that by the time that he had started earning this pension, his wife had abandoned him. She had abandoned the relationship. And that was one of the primary factors that the court considered.
So you would suggest then that a complete separation or abandonment of the relationship, as you say, prior to the earnings being accumulated equals compelling reasons, period.
No, I think it could, and it's up to the court after hearing the testimony, after hearing the evidence, that if the court believes that in that particular case before it, that those circumstances do, in the court's mind, produce the most just result that it can, and they shouldn't be limited to not look at those.
But doesn't the statute require us to first find, or the trial court, to first find compelling reason, step one, and then explain for the record, as the appellant suggests, what those compelling reasons are? If we look at the legislative history, it's pretty clear that the initial intent of this particular equal distribution statute was equal distribution, period. Absent compelling reasons. So it's, you got to find compelling reasons to deviate, and then you got to lay them out. Did the judge do that here?
I believe that he did. And while the appellant may be critical of the order that he wrote for not containing the magic words compelling reasons or not describing them consistently with what was stated in the hearing, I don't think that that can be held against my client. He was in pro per. He didn't draft the order. If anything, it should be construed against the appellants in this case. And I think that you're correct, that the first step is that there's a presumption that the property is to be divided equally. But that, as you can see from the legislative history, this bill was advanced by the Nevada Trial Lawyers Association, and when they were arguing why this is appropriate, they said that we first need to address the fact that this is equal. And that's the first step. But we want to give the courts wide discretion to consider many other circumstances to determine whether in this particular case an unequal distribution is the most just result.
And you know, let me ask you this. My understanding for the basis for this judge making that determination that he was willing to make an unequal distribution was that essentially no community existed. And reading his order, that's essentially all he said, isn't it?
I think that is the primary reason, and that is what ultimately he felt was the most compelling circumstance.
What's bothersome there is we have statutes that define what a community is and what it isn't, and in this particular case, They were still married. There was never any dissolution of that marriage. There was a separation. It wasn't even a legal separation. So tell me how that plays into this.
Well, there are statutes that address what is community property.
Correct.
And the statutes, and I believe that the Forrest versus Forrest case says that community property is from the date you're married to the date that some decree is entered, either it be a formal separation or a divorce decree.
That's correct.
And that determines what the property is characterized. And I don't think that there's any dispute that the property was community property here. And that's the first inquiry. The court analyzed the issue under NRS 125-150, which only deals with the division of community property. And so there's no dispute that this property was community property, but then there's the next step, which the court can look at any other circumstance. And I don't think that the court should be constrained to not look at the fact that one party left the other and they went on with their different lives, had other significant others, had other children, never contributed or even tried to reconcile from that point, and that by one circumstance, a party had obtained employment through no help or support or contribution from the other, worked there for 10 years with no contribution, support, or anything from the other, that the court shouldn't be constrained to not consider that as potentially being a compelling circumstance. And the
aren't you reintroducing then the concept of marital fault, like this is a no-fault state, but when they amended this statute, it was to eliminate the concept of marital fault as a reason to deny an equal division, fault in the sense of cruelty or other grounds. I mean, our case law is pretty clear. It has to have an economic impact before they're going to say there's justification for unequal distribution. Could you comment on that? And also comment on 155 in the PERS statute.
Yes, Justice Pickering. With regard to fault, I don't think that it reintroduces fault. The reasons why the parties separated is not at issue. It's the fact that they did separate and the pension was earned entirely afterwards. As you can see from the legislative history, one of the concerns that was being advanced by the NCLA when they were trying to put this bill forward was that as a result of several prior decisions by this court that the real central issue now in all divorce litigation was trying to vilify the other party because it could potentially be relevant under the prior statutory scheme, which was the just and equitable division, because after the McNabney versus McNabney decision came down, at least according to the NCLA, they were interpreting and seeing lawyers who now thought that the community property, the equal division, had been eroded, and that now courts were free to divide property however they pleased without any framework in place. And so I don't think that it reintroduces fault. It just has to do with the circumstances. We're not talking about she left because of whatever reason. That would be irrelevant unless it had some adverse economic impact on the other party. And the other issue that I believe you wanted me to address was 125-155 with the PERS pensions. And it says in there that the length of the pension is determined from the date of the marriage till the date of the divorce. And that's the same as it is in with respect to any other property. There's no difference. But as you can see, in that statute, I disagree with the appellant that that's a codification of the common law with respect to everything. It even says directly before it defines the time period that it only applies to PERS pensions and judicial retirement pensions. That specific statute is only dealing with that circumstance. But I do think that the length of time determining what is community property now is the same regardless. There's one step further to determine, okay, given it is community property, are there other circumstances that the court, the person who heard the parties, was familiar with the case, did they feel that those warranted an unequal division?
But the compelling, again, going back to what the judge indicated as the compelling reason. What exactly was the compelling reason, and is that consistent with what was contemplated when there was a discussion in the legislature?
I believe that the primary compelling reason was that she had left the marriage, that she had abandoned him. And I think that that is consistent. The court considered that. It is not the dispositive issue, as it would be when we're talking about characterization of the property. If like California, it ends on separation, the inquiry would be done at that point, and we wouldn't even be considering this because they wouldn't have discretion to make that.
California is different. They've said it straight up. You know, that they've set a line that we don't yet have here in Nevada.
And I agree. And we're not disputing that it wasn't community property. I think that inquiry more focuses on the characterization. Is it separate property or is it community property? And that's really where I think that inquiry comes in. And I don't think it's inconsistent that just because it is community property that you can't consider the circumstances under which it was earned. And I would like to address one point real briefly, which the appellant's counsel addressed with the Empire pension, the pension that was earned during the marriage. And he said it only had a couple $100 value. Well, that's not true. It was $90 a month. The quadro was only $350. So it took 3 months, and my client paid for all of that anyways, to divide the property. So it's not as though he got everything and she got nothing. He got the pension that he earned after she had abandoned him. And then she got the entirety of the pension that was earned during the marriage. And I've done the math on that, and it works out to be $1,100 a year. The average life expectancy of a person who's 58 years old, like Mr. Hallenbeck, is 22 years. And so the total value, expected value of that pension is approximately $24,000. So it's not like there was a significantly, you know, he got everything, she got nothing. She got what she contributed to, all of it, and he got what he only contributed to. And I'd also like to address one brief point with respect to Nevada and Idaho that the appellant's counsel addressed, where it said that the Idaho had legislated specific factors that they thought that the court consider in determining compelling circumstances. And the legislature made those non-inclusive. They just, here are examples. Nevada didn't do that, which shows that they weren't. And you'll see in the legislative history, it was even asked, should we put a list of factors? And they said no, because we don't want to constrain the court's hands. We want them to be able to free to consider everything, and as long as they follow the proper legal standards, that their discretion should not be reversed. And then unless the... And one other issue, the record as a whole, even if based on the decree alone or what was said in the transcript, the record as a whole supports affirmance here. You have that the court primarily relied on the fact that there was no community, that she had been. But the other factors that the court implicitly considered was the history of the marriage, the lack of any relationship after Mrs. Hallenbeck left, and during the entire time of the employment where the pension was earned, that the fact that the wife had not contributed under any interpretation of the word to this pension, the fact that there were no minor children to be cared for, and the fact that Mr. Hallenbeck had been unemployed for 2 years prior. These are all within the record. I believe that the court has the ability, if it thinks that alone the court didn't specifically set forth the reasons sufficiently, that the court can go back and determine whether compelling circumstances existed, but that some level of deference should be given to the district court because it was there.
I have one question. I think that the law clearly, Forrest and a number of other cases, clearly compels us to find that this was community property. So we have to start with that proposition.
Agreed.
Here's where I get conflicted. The judge, although he didn't say this is separate property, did seem to err by saying there was no community, because the law says until there is legal dissolution, this community exists. Would you agree with me so far?
No, I don't think that he analyzed the issue under the
I'm going to get to that. Just follow with me. Okay. I'm going to get to that part because I think I because I think you and I may be on the same page, frankly. Okay, so here's my concern. I think you have to call this pension community property. His comment about it, there was no community, is problematic. Because then I think we can follow the analysis that you are urging. If we accept this as community property, then let us defer to the trial court to assess all those factors that you're talking about and decide whether or not it is ultimately the fairest way to divide this community property. But here we have a problem. He said, no community. Isn't that legal error?
I don't think so. I think he was trying to describe what he felt was the primary issue that he had, that he felt was a compelling enough circumstance, given the fact that it was community property, that it should be divided unequally. And so that's why I don't think that it is error per se. It's just maybe not the most articulate way to talk about his reasons.
Thank you, Pat.
So would you say then that he's substituting, in essence, he's using community not as a term of art, but rather as there was no longer any marital relationship, no unity of a family, that kind of concept?
Yes, Your Honor, precisely.
And should we interpret a record like this that way? I think Justice Sata and I are both struggling with that.
And I can see where it could be problematic, but I don't think that it should be taken that he found that it wasn't community property, which I think that would be where it is very troubling. He analyzed it under the statute that deals with community property, and he never found in either in the hearing or in the order that this is separate property. While it says it's going to be held in there separate, that's just another kind of misuse of the correct terminology. And unless there's any further questions, I see I've exceeded.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, you got about a minute and 1:07 left.
I won't need all of that because Justice Sata basically made my argument just a minute ago. The trial court didn't consider compelling reasons. It simply found that it wasn't community. The reasoning was faulty. The finding of the judge was faulty. I submit if we look at the definition of abuse of discretion and we look at respondent's argument that the court had discretion, the definition of abuse of discretion is making a pronouncement in the absence of any substantial evidence in the record or reaching a conclusion on an identifiably erroneous legal rationale. And I suppose I submit to the court that the trial court, in finding that this wasn't community, clearly made a pronouncement that was identifiably erroneous legal rationale. And finally,
Could I ask you a question, though, about that? The written findings of fact and conclusions of law in paragraph 6 says, and I'll paraphrase a bit, the pension benefits, comma, while earned during the marriage, comma, was earned after the parties separated, and it is fair that they be set aside to the plaintiff as his sole and separate property. Why should we not interpret that sentence as articulating what to this judge was the compelling reason for dividing that community asset unequally? He's stating that the reason for what he did was that it was earned entirely after the parties separated, and in his view that's fair. And everything else in this decree, he gives each side whatever they had and whatever debt they had incurred. He says each of you is on your own with those things. That seems to me to be a fair articulation, if not a great one, of compelling reason.
But if we look to the actual words of the judge in his decision, he says that since the money was contributed to the pension after the separation, she is not entitled as a matter of community property, even though they were legally married. I think that's what the court has to look at as the real rationale of the court. And finally, if I may...
And that's the transcript?
Yes.
Okay. Please continue.
And finally, I realize my time is up, but I have one more point, that NRS 125.155, the PERS division of the statute, says that it's to be divided from the date of the marriage to the date of the divorce. There is nothing in that statute that says that may be deviated from by compelling circumstances. And therefore, the application of a different standard to non-PERS pensions could be discriminatory.
All right, counsel, thank you for the arguments and the briefs. It was helpful, and we will stand in recess. This case is submitted. We'll stand in